Well, I have to say, I found this surprising. At the time of the American Revolution, 5% of the population in the 13 colonies was Muslim, mostly enslaved people from West Africa. The role of Islam in shaping American identity can be tracked back to the 1500s and also noted in the writing of founding fathers. In fact, the first country to acknowledge American nationhood was the Sultanate of Morocco. So a key figure in understanding early Muslim American identity is Omar ibn Said. He arrived in the port of Charleston in chains in 1807. And after escaping his first enslaver, Said was recaptured and sold in Fayetteville, North Carolina, where he wrote letters and an autobiography in Arabic. Two scholars have taken on the task of translating the writing and placing it into the proper context. Mbai Low is a professor of Asian and Middle Eastern Studies at Duke University. Mbai, welcome back to The State of Things.
Thank you for inviting us.
Pleasure to have you, and it's a pleasure to welcome back Carl Ernst, a professor of Islamic Studies at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Hello, Carl.
Hi, Frank.
And by, let's start with you. Tell us a bit about what we know about Said's background and training in what is now Senegal before enslavement.
Well, thank you for inviting us to discuss this topic. It is very timely and very relevant. Omar ibn Said, that is how he wrote his name, but mostly known in the U.S. and in the academia as Omar ibn Said. That has to do with mistranslation. So according to what we know from Omar's writing, he was born in Futatoro. Futatoro is the region is the region around the Senegal River, between Senegal and Mauritania, if you just can imagine the map of West Africa. He was born in 1770 and he was unfortunately taken into slavery in 1807. He doesn't tell us in details what had happened, except his village was invaded and an army sold him to foreigners whom he called Christian. And he was taken to Charleston, South Carolina, where he spent 2 years actually. So we are assuming that Omar arrived in Charleston on January 5th, 1808, because that was the last cargo to came from West Africa, because the foreign trade in slavery ceased to exist after that time. And then after 2 years in Charleston in slavery, he ran up north to Fayetteville into a church where he was discovered and arrested and put in jail, looking for his owner. As you know, in 1793, we have the Runaway Act that slaves have to be captured and returned to their owners. So while in jail for 2 weeks, he started writing on the jail's wall in Arabic using the charcoal that was available. And it was just that news that an intellectual writing Negro wasn't very common, and it just spread in town. And after two weeks, Bob Mumford, who was the sheriff, took him home. And Bob Mumford was related to the Owen family, very prominent family, was in-law to James Owen. And James Owen came over and took Omar home. And then the new connection between the Owen family and Omar started. And that is basically the life of Omar. Omar lived this until the beginning of the Civil War. He died in 1863.
But Carl, there's a significant amount of, a fair amount of unpacking we can do there. Well, let's start with the fact, Carl, that he is in a jail in Fayetteville, mm-hmm. and he's writing, and there's this beautiful scroll, an Arabic script that's going up on the walls, and it's attracting a lot of people, which is phenomenal in and of itself. But also the reason they pull him out is because this is running counter to the narrative of white supremacy and the whole premise of slavery. Right, Carl?
Well, that's right. And the prejudice was so strong that people had a difficulty in actually recognizing who this man was. And when it became clear that he was educated and literate, they said, well, this couldn't possibly be an African. And we find people making up stories about him that maybe he was an Arabian prince who somehow ended up here in a romantic fashion. So the writing was fascinating to people, but they didn't know what to make of it, and it was ultimately incomprehensible.
Yeah, and but also we need to get him out of there because this public display of this kind of intellect is not anything we want. So let's take him out of public view, which I find fascinating. And by also this year, 1808, when he arrives, is significant. As you point out, this is the year that it becomes illegal for the transatlantic trade. So there's no more foreign trade in slavery. It's still legal in the United States, but you can't import slaves anymore. This was the end, and the fact that Omar himself was captured is a suggestion that even the slave traders understood that things were running to an end and were getting desperate and reaching into the towns where not the typical slave trade were to be found. Is that right?
Yes, that is true. And Omar was too old to be enslaved. He was 37, and normally, according to many studies, age of slaves were really young up till 30 or 25 maximum. But you can just imagine the traders, they need to make money, so they will take the last one available. So it is also very, very important for us to look at, I think that is what Carl was talking about, how Omar became a prince of Arabia. Because in 1825, a doctor from Fayetteville met Omar and wrote an article about him. The article was published in the Christian Advocate, and it was just picked up on national level. The African Repository, which was published by the Journal of American Colonization Society, picked it up. And another journal in Philadelphia, American Recorder, picked it up. And we with few students, we're looking at how once they pick up the same article, they change the title of the article. So you can see an evolving image of Omar from the Prince of Arabia, from someone from Timbuktu, from so on. So there was a remaking of Omar's image during this earlier time, actually.
But it was a national image. It was one that was becoming well known all across the country. Is that right?
Right. I mean, I remember reading somewhere that the most popular images in the antebellum South were basically Frederick Douglass and Omar Ibn Said. Because, as you know, abolitionists, they pick up the case of Omar because that is a very marketable case, that here's someone who is prince, who is educated, and he had to spend the rest of his life enslaved in what used to be called the peculiar institution of slavery. So that is how you have so many visitors coming to the Owens household in order to meet with Omar.
Carl, talk about Omar's relationship with the Owens family.
Well, it was apparently a very positive relationship. Omar was very happy to escape from Johnson, his abusive master in Charleston. And the Owen family treated him with great kindness. He was not subjected to manual labor. He states that he was dressed and fed like them. And so it was a relationship that was possible on the sort of extremes of the slavery institution, that some people were treated better than others.
Mbai, talk about his writing, too, and the way in which he wrote about his situation, because it can be seen as subversive, a form of resistance, but he also speaks in glowing terms about the family and his enslaver. But you can see in his writing, and maybe you can give us some examples of his understanding that this institution of slavery is absolutely wrong, and right from the very first chapter of his autobiography.
Right. So that is actually the task that brought me and Professor Carl Ernst to really decipher Omar's work. Also, it has been around almost for 200 years, but we found the current interpretations and translations very, very, very limiting. This has to do with slave writing. If you remember, Frederick Douglass wrote in 1955 that a free human being cannot see things in the same light with the slave, because he does not and cannot look from the same point from which the slave does. So that does not only apply on Frederick Douglass' writing, but on Omar Ibn Said's writing as well. So I'll just read to you a few paragraphs from the autobiography which he wrote in 1831. So he starts from Omar to Sheikh Hunter. Sheikh Hunter was an American abolitionist. We are still trying to figure out who was Hunter himself, but he calls him Sheikh. Sheikh is just a title of respect. From Omar to Sheikh Hunter, you ask me to write my life. I cannot write my life. for I have forgotten much of my own language, as well as that of Arabic. Also, I know little grammar and little vocabulary. Oh, my brothers, I ask you, in the name of God, not to blame me, for my eyes are weak, so is my body. My name is Omar ibn Sayyid. My birthplace was Futa Toro between the two rivers.
We're going to return to this reading as I'm talking with my two guests right now, Mbai Lo, who is a professor in the Department of Asian and Middle Eastern Studies at Duke University. Professor, what I'm going to ask you to do is maybe start back about another paragraph because we lost some of what you were saying. And there's a particular section, as long as we've got this break, where he invokes the image of God, of course not the name of God because he's a Muslim, but makes it clear that only God can own people.
Right.
And I wonder if you can talk about that
section. That is the beginning. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, I may just let Carl talk about that because that is actually the autobiography. The first segment of the autobiography was a chapter from the Quran called Suratul Mulk. So maybe Professor Carl can just elaborate on it.
Can you do that while we work on this phone line? Carl?
Certainly. There are some really interesting problems in interpreting this text. And one of them is that slave writing was illegal. In other words, it was impossible for people who were enslaved to write on their own account. And then slave narratives that we have published are all written by people who were free from slavery and then can have the liberty to reflect on it in their own thinking. Omar's writing is the only one we have that is written in the condition of slavery. And it's a kind of an impossible task that was set to him, or that he set himself. But the manuscript begins with a quotation of 30 verses from one chapter of the Quran, the Surat al-Mulk, or the chapter of the kingdom. And it is a powerful statement that God is the master, creator, and Lord of the universe. And so it's not an argument for abolitionism in the strict sense of the term, but it certainly forms a framework for his condition.
Carl, let's talk a little bit more about the life of Omar in the United States and in Fayetteville. You say he lives with the Owens family. He's writing. What is his life like? What is he doing all this time? And we should point out, he lived for a very long time, right?
He did. He was over 80 years old when he died. And he attended the Presbyterian church services in Wilmington with the Owen family in their pew, and he had a boy who cooked for him. He had his own apartment inside the house. He was brought out regularly to meet visitors, and he was apparently asked on many occasions to demonstrate his skill of writing in Arabic. And some of the documents that we have that survive, which we should come back to, there are 15 that we are aware of. Some of them are the names of family members of the Owens or other people that he knew in Wilmington, the Taylor family, for instance. And there is a possibility that some of these documents were talismanic blessings that were protective and would have power to help people. So he was a celebrity.
Well, I was going to ask you, do we have any understanding or any way of knowing how well received he was and what kind of status he had in Fayetteville?
Well, the accounts that we have by people who met him, there was a man named Ford to whom he gave a document. And he gives a kind of vivid account of the warmth and sincerity of Omar, who approached him and grasped his hands between his own. And he was obviously a person who impressed others with his character and his gentle and courteous demeanor. He was a unique individual in many ways.
Mbai, talk about religion here, because it is clear that he was going to the Presbyterian Church. Do we have a sense that he converted? What was his thinking about Christianity and Islam?
Well, that is what we are trying to find out. I think that the challenge we have, and we owe it to future generation, is we must
know
how.
We're going to try to get that line back with Mbai. Maybe, Carl, you can answer that for us as we try to get Mbai back, this relationship between Christianity and Islam when he's in this very difficult situation.
Well, the family was keenly interested in having him convert to Christianity. And John Lewis Taylor, who was the first Supreme Court Justice of North Carolina, became involved. And he wrote to Francis Scott Key, the composer of our national anthem, in an effort to obtain an Arabic Bible for Omar. And their thought was that this would help to facilitate his conversion. Now, it's really complex because in the autobiography, when Omar describes studying the gospel, he then interprets it by quoting works of Islamic theology. And this is something which has not previously been recognized because people did not realize that he was quoting classical works from the Arabic Islamic tradition. And in addition, when we look at the Arabic Bible, which is preserved in the library at Davidson College here in North Carolina, we find that he had a very minimal engagement with the Arabic text of the Bible. He quotes in his writings 20 different passages from the Quran, but only four from the Bible. And those four were ones that were often used in worship, in practice. For instance, the Lord's Prayer from the New Testament, the 23rd Psalm, the 123rd Psalm, and then there's a passage from the Book of Romans. And so, but what was curious indeed is that he had learned how to write English words and names in the Arabic script. He developed a technique for doing this. And in the Bible, he wrote out, one of the only things he did was for about 35 of the biblical books, he wrote in the margin the title of the book, the English title of the book, using Arabic letters. And we can hear a Southern accent in the way he did this. So, for instance, the book of Psalms is just written as Psalm. The book of Mark as Mark.
Oh, that's interesting, because he's got a phonetic. He's phoneticizing what he's hearing as he translates into Arabic, and the phonetics suggest the Southern accent that he's picking up.
That's right. And when he writes, for instance, a date in the English language date in Arabic script, he writes November 4. 1819.
Are there any other ways in Mbai that Southern culture is reflected in his writing?
Yes. Before I elaborate on that point, I wanted to add to what Carl was talking about, Omar's conversion to Christianity. I think it shouldn't be a problem for us to focus on did he convert or not. It is customary for Muslims taken as hostage in the West to convert to Christianity. We have many examples from Omar to others. But as scholars, we want the evidence to support that argument. And so far, there is no evidence to that end. If you look at Omar came to the Owen family in 1810, but his conversion to Christianity was 10 years later, in 1820. And it took Francis Scott Key, who's well-known, he's the author of the American National Anthem, and Chief Justice John Tyler to actually make global contact to get an Arabic language Bible for Omar. So you'll see some global concerted effort to pressure Omar to become Christian. So this is extremely important. So we move from this point to look at the evidence in Omar's writing, and that is what Professor what Carl was talking about. The evidence is not very 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 convincing. So did the Southern culture impact Omar's writing? I should argue yes. A few weeks ago, we found out, we were able to actually have a breakthrough in some Omar's used words, which was shahra. So in all the four translations of Omar's work from 1848, the first translation by Alexander Cohill, and to the second translation in 1860 by Isaac Bird, to the third translation by Professor Jameson in 1925 to 2011 translation by Rice. So all the translation, they left this word untranslated. So as far as we were working on it, so basically here's an example. Omar would say, after 2 years in Charleston, I ran into X place from the house of Johnson. And once later when I arrive in, I'm just putting X. X is the missing spot. When I arrive in Fayetteville, I ran into X place. A child saw me and told his dad, I saw a black man in the X place. His father came and took me from the X place of God. So we discover actually X place is the word church.
Mm.
Because church did not exist in West Africa at the time. So Omar, the only way for Omar to articulate church is he translated the word. So Shahra is the way you write church. And I called two friends of mine in Senegal who have no understanding of English. I asked them, okay, I'm going to pronounce this word. Can you write it for me in Arabic? Actually, what they wrote was what Omar wrote. It was Omar ran away from Charlestown to a church, because we know Underground Railroad, the church was the main station for runaway slaves.
Right.
It makes sense for him to run from the house to a church. When he came to Fayetteville, he went to a church because he went to a place to pray. He had to pray into a church. So we have seen so many of this actually articulated in the translation.
Well, yes, it's also interesting to talk about, Carl. Let me ask you about this, because this notion of converting may have been because, you know, the Owen family felt the need to save a soul. But this was becoming a critical point in the American South to protect the institution of slavery. I mean, talk about the fear that was now running through slave owners in the South related to religion and Islam.
Well, that's true. And slave owners were very committed to controlling the slaves' population. And the prohibition against writing was part of that, because any kind of individual expression was feared to be the source of possible rebellion.
The role of Islam, I guess that's what I'm getting at, because we talked about this 5% of the population, which, you know, may come as a surprise to some, you know, around the time of the revolution. Islam played an important part in the foundation of this country. It plays a role, and maybe we could talk about that role and the fact that certainly slave owners were aware of it.
Well, it's true, and it had come up in the constitutional debates in Fayetteville, 1789, where people were debating the clause for the religious requirement for the presidency. And the question came up, what if the president is a Mohammedan? And that was actually approved at the time. But the opposition to conversion among the slaves was not easy to maintain. And this is at the same time, we also have the Colonization Society, which is trying to send freed slaves to Liberia. But it is astonishing to see how deep the conversion missionary activity was at the time. It was just assumed without question by many people that this was something that would be desirable. And furthermore, that it would demonstrate the benevolent aspects of slavery if it could be shown that slaves would give up the false religion to embrace Christianity. So there was not really a lot of debate about this at the time, but it was integrated into the realms of social control that were part of the armature of slavery.
Carl, I mentioned earlier that Rhiannon Giddens has adapted Sayid's writings to an opera. I wonder if you've seen any of that work. And again, with translation now has become a very important part of this conversation. Are you involved in that discussion?
Well, yes, I have been in touch with the producer of that production, and I shared with them some of the research that Mbailo and I have done, including the Arabic text, the theological text, the Sufi text that he quotes, and also pointed out the limitation on his knowledge of the Bible. And so I'm certainly happy if any of that is helpful to them in their as they move forward, because the performance, as you know, at the Spoleto festival has to be postponed until next year. But it's an exciting project, and I'm really hoping I can see it next June.
And by talk about the significance of this, as you say, this autobiography has been, available from the beginning. It's been, so it's not that it hasn't been out there. Translations have been a problem. But talk about the significance of his work in general and what it tells us and how it changes, perhaps, our understanding of what life was like in slavery.
It is very, very, very relevant for the discipline and for society at large. It is worthy for us also to understand that antebellum southern setting was very rich with intellectual black figures like Omar. If you remember, we have George Moses Horton, who was actually, I'm still trying to figure out, who lived in a farm plantation here in Chapel Hill, who wrote in the 2 years earlier, in 1829, The Hope of Liberty, in which he wrote some beautiful line. I will read here: "Must I dwell in slavery's night, and all pleasure take its flight, for beyond my feeble sight forever." And I remember reading that Governor Owens was actually informed of this slave's request, and he promised to pay $100 more on the slave's regular price, but his owner didn't free him, and it took him until the 13th Amendment after the Civil War in 1864 to get his freedom. So, and also, if you remember, and at the same time, the same year Omar wrote his autobiography, also you have other existing autobiographies in writing or in revolution. You have the Nat Turner's Revolution in Virginia. Over 50 white slaveholders were killed. And at the same time, also, you have David Walker's appeal, if you remember. So first time a black man is sending an appeal comparing the life of slaves under white occupation similar to the life of white under British occupation, and it was a moral dilemma for the society, actually. So Omar wasn't alone in this intellectual. What makes him alone was his writing in a different language. The first time someone is writing in a non-European language. So that contested white supremacy's view that black learned to write under white education system. And the second point is the first time someone has written autobiography in bondage, while in bondage. But there are other contesting autobiographies. So I think, to put it in context, this is the beauty of Omar's work. And hopefully we'll be able to decipher the meanings and look at what it tells us about society at the time and how he lived his life. That's really an academic question that myself and Carl would like to answer in the coming days and months. Yeah.
Mbai Lo is a professor of Asian and Middle Eastern Studies at Duke University. Carl Ernst, a professor of Islamic Studies at UNC Chapel Hill. Thank you both for being on the program.
Thank you very much, Frank.
You can find out more about Omar Ibn Said and the rest of our show at our website, stateofthings.org.